The number of people involved in the trade unions is continuing to advance. There are still in a situation where new trade unions are being formed. In 1921, a rather bizarre union was formed, the Association of University Teachers. That's pretty bizarre. For the first time, university teachers formed a trade union. It's very unusual. Remember, university teachers were much more privileged at the time than they are today, although even today, I suppose, it's not so bad. And a whole load of other trade unions were formed. The General Union of Carpenters, the Amalgamated Union of Building Trade Workers, the Marine Workers Union. And also, interestingly enough, in the 20s, the National Unemployed Workers Movement. The National Unemployed Workers Movement. And the National Unemployed Workers Movement organized after 1922 a whole series of marches to protest against the situation of unemployed people. In 1924, the General and Municipal Workers Union is founded. Which brings us to 1925. So we have, again, another big clash in 1925. The mine owners, the private companies, the mine companies, announced that they intend to reduce miners' wages. Okay, the economy is not going so well. There's quite a lot of unemployment. The companies are not finding it easy to make a good profit, and so they're deciding to reduce the miners' wages. Remember, they got a big increase in 1919, and now the threat is to reduce them. The Trade Union Congress, so the Federation of Trade Unions, replied and said, no, we will support the miners. If there is a problem, we will support them. If there is a strike, we will support them. Very important because, of course, from the point of view of the Federation of Trade Unions, they knew very well that the miners were the strongest union, and so it's a symbol. It's a symbol, yeah. Or the other trade unions said, oh, well, if the miners lose, we have no chance. Yeah, it's a very, very important symbolic thing. For a moment, it's not quite sure what the situation will be. The government is not quite sure for a few days what to do. And finally, the railway workers, the transport workers, and the miners make a joint announcement that if the miners' wages are cut, we will all go on strike. And the government decides that this would be too terrible, and so the government agrees to give money to keep the miners' wages as they are, a subsidy, in subvention, the government gives money. Okay, this is 1925. This particular announcement of the three biggest unions is known in trade union history as Red Friday, Le Vendredi Rouge. Yeah? That is to say, the day when it was enough for the trade unions to threaten to strike. And they already won. However, the government subsidy, the money from the government, was only going to last for 9 months. This is the we will subsidy for 9 months. So there was always a danger going on. And in the meantime, they established a commission under the leadership of Sir Herbert Samuel to look into the problems of the mining industry. So really, in a way, the government has postponed the problem. Yeah? No wage cuts for 9 months. What will happen in 9 months? We don't know. And of course, both sides are preparing. Yeah? You know, the miners think, next year there might be a strike. And the employers also think that. So they're preparing. It's fair enough. And the government report, the Samuel Commission, republishes its report in March 1926. And they recommend that the government subsidy should be withdrawn and the miners' wages should be reduced. That's what the commission reduces. I can't remember. The commission says that the government subsidy should be withdrawn, que la subvention gouvernementale soit retirée, et donc que les salaires des mineurs soient réduits. Now I simplify a little bit. Then the companies, the mine owners, were feeling rather confident, and so they said, well, here are the new contracts with the new wages. They are reduced. Okay, that's life. It's necessary. We have no choice. And if you do not accept, if the miners do not accept this, then on the 1st of May we will close the mines. Yeah. So the initial thing is, this is what we call, you remember the word, a lockout. Yeah, a lockout in grève des employeurs. Eh? So that's what they say. They say, okay, listen, you must sign these new conditions with lower wages, or on the 1st of May, we will close the mines. That this is to say that the companies are quite confident, but also it is kind of an all or nothing, yeah? It's a direct conflict. We're not avoiding the conflict. We want a direct conflict. We want to win. On the 1st of May, the Trade Union Congress, the Confederation, meets and announces that a general strike in defense of the miners will begin on the 3rd of May. Okay, here, so each side is chaque côté élève les enjeux. It's all looking very bad. The Labour Party was not so happy about this idea. They were hoping for a negotiated agreement. You know, the Labour Party were not in favour of a general strike. You know, the Labour Party was in general in favour of better conditions, but only by negotiation. And a section of the trade union leadership were also rather unhappy about a general strike. But nevertheless, the trade union congress called a general strike and took over the negotiations with the government from the Miners' Federation. They almost found an agreement on Sunday night. This was day by day stuff. Suddenly, the rather an accidental point, the workers who worked for the Daily Mail, a newspaper, refused to print an article which attacked the strike. And so we're not printing an article against the strike. And using this as the reason, the Prime Minister said, oh, well, it's impossible to negotiate then. Okay, go ahead, strike, we'll see who wins. So at the last moment, it wasn't... So everybody imagined, it was quite interesting, yeah, because everybody imagined that... a lot of people say, oh, there won't really be a general strike. I mean, they'll find an agreement this weekend. And it was quite probable, but in fact they didn't, and the strike began the next day. And the Trade Union Congress had a plan, had a strategy, tactics. They said that the first day we will bring out 3 million people, railway men, transport workers, dockers, printers, builders, iron and steel workers, and the others we will call out later. We're not asking everybody to strike at the same time. We're going to begin with 3 million, and then a week later, another 3 million, and so on. And that's what we're going to do. And so they did. They did, and the general strike begins. It will last 10 days, which is a lot for a general strike, actually. It's extremely... I don't have too many details here, unfortunately. Oh, yes, maybe I do. Oh yes, I have it day by day a little bit later on. But let me tell you the end of the story and then go back to the beginning. A few days into the strike, the leaders of the Trade Union Congress met in a secret meeting with Herbert Samuel, the chairman of the Royal Commission, and found an agreement to... proposed an agreement, and this agreement involved some concessions by the government, but still some reduction of wages. An intermediate agreement. The Trade Union Congress, so the leadership of the Federation, agreed called off strikes, and okay, the strike is finished. But the miners, the leaders of the miners, did not agree, and the miners will stay on strike for several months. Okay. Now this becomes a rather controversial part of British trade union history, because the miners consider that the leadership of the trade union Congress betrayed them, abandoned them when they were needed, whereas the leaders of the trade union Congress thought that it was impossible to win a general strike. So again, it's very difficult to know exactly which was. Okay, so that's what happened. Yeah, the TUC called off the general strike. It's a little bit more complicated than that. Another reason the trade union Congress abandoned the general strike was because there had been a couple of cases in the tribunal where the judge, the same day, the judge had declared that the general strike was illegal. And that the trade unions would have to pay a lot of money in fines and compensation. So here you get some of the reasons for it, because the if you get this situation where you have a big strike and the tribunal says it's illegal, and so the union will have to pay a lot of money in fines, the strikers, the miners, they're saying, well, it is essential for us that we do not have a reduction in wages. If this means that all the money of the union disappears, well, that's terrible, but no, that's life. The trade union leaders depend on the union's money, and so they are much more worried about that. And so that kind of pressure meant that that this general division between members of union and professional negotiators it became stronger. So on the 11th of May, the Trade Union Congress General Committee decides to accept these conditions, and they visit 10 Downing Street to announce that the general strike is over, and they try to persuade the government to guarantee that there will be no victimization. Because once the strike is lost and you go back to work, the problem is, from the point of view of the strikers, is how do you stop? The employer says, okay, the leaders, 1, 2, 3, you're sacked. This victimization. There's always a big problem after strikes. And so that was the aim of the TUC. The government, the government refused to guarantee. In fact, the government said, we have no power to compel employers to take back every man who has been on strike. But they refused to help, really. And the miners continue until October or November, the strike, and the situation is quite bad, because they are quite a lot never get their job back. And those who do get their job back have lower wages. So very clear defeat for the miners. Very clear defeat for the miners. Interestingly enough, it has. I'm going to come back to the story of the general strike in a minute. But interestingly enough, it has a big political result, and that is that in 1927, so not immediately, but in 1927, the government passed a new law, the Trade Disputes and Trade Union Act. And this will limit Trade Disputes and Trade Union Act. And Trade Disputes Déclaration, les conflits sociaux, right? And Trade Union Act. And this law limits the activity of trade unions in different ways. First of all, it makes it illegal. It makes the sympathy strike illegal. That is to say, if you go on strike because your employer does something you don't like, that's legal. If you go on strike to support another group of workers, that's illegal. This is what we call the sympathy strike. Interestingly enough, these strikes were very common in Britain in the 50s, later in the 50s, 60s and 70s, and today they are again illegal. It's illegal to go on strike to support another group of workers in Britain. So there you go. It still happens. So one of the problems of making strikes illegal is it only works if you only have a few hundred strikers. If you have thousands, well, it's illegal, but there's 100,000 of them, nothing to do about it. Secondly, this new law in 1927 said that trade unions can only give money to political parties from those members who sign a document to say, yes, I agree. And so they make it more difficult. The law makes it more difficult to give money to political parties. In fact, it says political parties. In fact, it's the Labour Party that's the only one getting money. Thirdly, it was now illegal for civil service unions to join the TUC. Les syndicats de fonctionnaires ne pouvaient pas rejoindre la fédération des syndicats. Mm. Civil service, the fonction publique. Yeah. To join the TUC, the trade union, Congress, the confederation. So what does that mean? Well, it's not really complicated. Fundamentally, the strike was a defeat for the trade unions, and so when they make a new law the next year, then the law is unfavorable to trade unions. In the same way, in other situations, if a big strike is a victory for the trade unions, sometimes there will be a new law saying making things better for trade unions. The law reflects what's going on. Yeah, the law reflects what's going on. You cannot just pass laws if you're a government. You have to think about who will be in a position to be opposition. Yeah, it's all very complicated. Some people say, just to choose an example from France, some people say that the law about the 35 hours, les 35 heures, was an indirect result of the big strike in 1995. That's one opinion, one theory. Yeah, that the law changes things, but it depends on what happened before. Right, let's just go back to another couple of elements of the story of the general strike, because it really was. I spoke to somebody who was involved in the general strike many years ago, an old man who was the father of my girlfriend, and he was involved in the general strike. And I said, well, he was a student. He was a student at the time. I said, well, what did you do in the general strike? He said, well, we went on the bridges, and we threw coal at the scabs. Some trains were running with volunteer replacement drivers. Yeah, and the left-wing students would go and throw coal at them, you know, to try to discourage them. It was a very, very big mobilization. A lot of middle-class people, teachers, lawyers, doctors, students, because students were very much more middle-class at the time, were asked to replace important workers, to drive the buses, to drive the trains, and so on. There was a real mobilization to try to defeat the strike by replacing strikers. Yeah, 10 days, yeah? Is it 10 days or 9 days? 9 days. 9 days with really a general strike. And it was very spectacular. For example, in one part of town, if you drive a van in a camionette, well, somebody from the trade union stops you. They're saying, well, there's a general strike on, you can't. And if you could say, oh yeah, but here I have a letter from the trade union saying it's important for the trade union. So, okay. Yeah. So the trade unions were actually controlling, in certain towns, really controlling, because also the trade unions were, they wanted it, they didn't want people to starve. Yeah. So they wanted, okay, food, okay. Yeah. But other things not. Yeah, there was a lot of things going on. Also, very, very important political conflict. Information is what we know, the importance of the media, and really in 1926 you see the importance of the media very, very big. All of the newspapers, of course, were not being produced. So what did the government do? The government decided to establish a new newspaper every day, the British Gazette, and the trade unions. The trade unions established their own newspaper. I can't find it anymore. The Daily Worker. Oh, is it the British Worker? I'm not sure about the exact. Oh yeah, the British Gazette and the British Worker. Yeah, the government established under the responsibility of a certain Winston Churchill. Yes, the British Gazette, and so that they had, so that they had. so that they had every day the government's opinion, yeah, the money, yeah. And on the other hand, the TUC originally they said, "Oh, right, no newspapers, we're all on strike." And they said, "Oh, well, you know, if the only one newspaper is the British government, no, we." So they had the British Worker, which is the TUC's newspaper. Very, very rapid, yes, very immediate. Immediately, several million workers. So, what did Churchill say about his newspaper? Churchill, in his newspaper, the British Gazette, said, "I do not agree that the TUC have as much right as the government to publish their side of the case and to exhort their followers to continue action. It is a very much more difficult task to feed the nation than it is to wreck it." And on the other hand, the TUC, they wrote in their newspaper, the British Worker, they wrote, "We are not making war on the people. We are anxious that the ordinary members of the public shall not be penalised for the unpatriotic conduct of the mine owners and the government." So here you see a very classic political conflict. So the government is saying, the strikers are unpatriotic. They are not British. Yeah? They are traitors. And the trade unions are saying, no, the government is being unpatriotic. We represent the British people. And this is it's a normal conflict. And when you read these two newspapers, they're wonderful newspapers, both of them, really. But, I mean, from a point of view of a historian, it was really very, very strong things. Now, of course, the... an interesting comment from the King, incidentally, bizarrely enough, a big crisis like this, King George V. Somebody told King George V that these strikers, they are revolutionaries. And King George V said, try living on their wages before you judge them. Donc il répond, on vous devrait essayer de vivre sur le salaire pour un roi, c'est assez surprenant. Il avait une certaine compréhension de comment vivre les gens tout simples. Okay, so of course the government was very, very well prepared because they had 9 months before to prepare, and so they created organizations to maintain different services. Strangely enough, there was very little, relatively little violent conflict. This is unusual, actually, because normally all the elements were there to imagine that strikers and non-strikers could have very serious fights. There were some fights, yes, but not so much, actually, strangely enough. And that's an interesting point as to know why not. Because if you compare with the mass strikes in Italy, only a few years before, much more violence. Why? Longer, very, very difficult question. The history of violence is always very, 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 very difficult. But some conflict with the army and so on. That's about the end of the story. That's about the end of the story there of the. Except that the general strike, like the First World War, is something which is a very powerful experience for people, and people don't forget what they did in the. We have the example in France today, you know, when we have the commemoration of May 1968, and you can see, although it seems I was 8, yeah, so I don't remember, but you can see that it is obviously very important to people. D'ailleurs, il y a d'innombrables revues qui. Pourquoi mai 68 n'a aucune importance? Page 12, 13, 16 à 25, 34. Yeah, everybody seems to be obsessed with it. So these kind of big conflicts, they really do form and change people's way of looking at the world, quite importantly. And the general strike was like that. And people really didn't forget it for a long, long time. So some sort of general conclusion on 1919-1926. Difficult one, because historians do not agree. Okay, you know, historians are not paid to agree with each other, and therefore they often don't. A section of the left-wing, not all the left-wing historians, but some left-wing historians, say that the idea of revolution in 1919 was not so ridiculous, that it was a dynamic which could have got there if there had been a political organization which was more solid. On the other hand, other historians say, no, there was never any danger of revolution because the British workers after the First World War of being patriotic were fundamentally moderate and not interested in destabilizing the system. These are questions which is extremely difficult to objectively solve once and for all. Yeah, the question, qu'est-ce qui aurait pu se passer? It's very, very difficult to do anything about. Certainly, however, the traditional view of Britain of a very calm, moderate nation is just untrue. It's just untrue. Yeah, the official, you know, le manuel d'histoire pour première année de collège never mentions 1919 and has one sentence on 1926 dans le genre malheureusement il y a eu une crève en 1926. So the traditional view that there are never any big conflicts in Britain is just untrue. However, what kind of conflicts were possible? That's an open question which you can't really prove. And very often, if you read the conclusions of historians, it depends very much on their political opinion. It's one of those questions. It's very difficult to be neutral about that. But trade unions will, by this time, so contrary to the 19th century, by this time, trade unions and trade union leaderships have got a permanent place in society and in the management of social conflict. After the 1920s, no government will try to abolish trade unions or ban trade unions at all in Britain. After the 1920s, in the middle of the 19th century, the governments were still thinking, oh, maybe it's possible to eliminate trade unionism forever. In the 20th century, this is no longer imagined, except by fascist organisations, yeah, which in Britain always remained a minority. In general, whether it's the left-wing government or the right-wing government, it is accepted that trade unions are part of the game, and that's, you know, and so the aim of government becomes to encourage this section of trade unionism and stop that section and make the trade unions more moderate, and so it becomes much more sophisticated. And you no longer have a situation like in the early on of the 19th century where the only problem is to stop trade unions existing. And that will be the case. Now, of course, this is just Britain. Most countries will follow something similar, except those countries who abandon a sort of democratic system. And so, of course, if you're organizing a trade union in Romania in the 1970s, or in Chile, the situation is different, but a lot of the major industrial countries will accept trade unions as part of the deal. Okay, that's all I have to say about that. Let's